I'm feeling kinda lonely too, if you don't mind. Can I sit down here beside you? Oh yeah, alright. If I seem to come on too strong, I hope that you will understand. I say these things cause I'd like to know if you're as lonely as I am, and if you'd mind sharing the night together.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Discourse, the show where we discuss film and television news, reviews, or any other pertinent pop culture items in the zeitgeist that we feel the need to weigh in on. I'm Ryan Oliver, and today with me I have a very special guest. He is the editor-in-chief and founder of TheSpool.net. He is a senior writer at Consequences Sound, and he is the host of More of a Comment Really, Hall of Faces, and Nathan Raven's HappyCast. Clint Worthington, welcome to The Discourse.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So happy to have you on, and I have to thank you. You did this wonderful piece over the week at Consequences Sound, ranking all the cold opens of Breaking Bad, and your piece and the response to your piece was actually the inspiration for us talking about what we're going to be talking about today. So, thank you.
No, of course. I'm glad to hear there was a response. Sometimes it's kind of hard to figure out whether, you know, because it's a 6,000-word piece. I literally wrote all of that day. So I did a bunch of research beforehand, but yeah, the actual writing of it was just sort of like I spent an entire day doing that. So it's nice to hear that, like, people are reading it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And that's impressive in and of itself. But as listeners probably already guessed, I'm sure you already saw when you clicked the podcast link, we are going to be talking about El Camino, a Breaking Bad movie that dropped on Netflix.
A Breaking Bad story, thank you very much.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Is it? I thought it was Breaking
Bad. Or maybe, am I thinking of a Star Wars story?
I think you're thinking of Star Wars. Yeah, it is Breaking Bad movie, but that's, I was going
to
make
I would
joke.
Love to see those. Like,
that would be great if they did more. Yeah, and we can definitely dive into it for sure. I think we're going to be getting into it.
I should probably retitle my review then. I think I'm reading my review for reference, and it's definitely that's in the headline. So
that's amazing.
Maybe you picked the wrong Breaking Bad expert.
Well, we'll see. We'll see as this episode progresses whether or not that is correct or not.
Yeah.
But a couple items of housekeeping before we get into the episode proper. As always, The Discourse is a part of the Playlist Podcast Network. So if you enjoy the show, be sure to subscribe to us via your podcatcher of choice, be it iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor FM. And you'll get this show as well as our other programs, including The Fourth Wall, Be Real, Indie Beat, and the other various things that pop up on our feed from time to time. A couple other items. One thing we should mention at the top, a little bit more sad news, is Robert Forster, the great character actor Robert Forster, who makes an appearance in El Camino, passed away this last week on Friday at the age of 78. And that was both sad and really surreal watching that movie that morning and then reading the news later in the day that he had passed away.
Yeah, it's really rare for an actor to die, a beloved actor no less, on the day one of his greatest performances gets released to the public.
We would
have been talking about Robert Forster that day even if he hadn't died. You know what I mean? Like, people just talking about how good. I mean, yes, it's reprising a role from Breaking Bad, but he gets a really great moment to shine, and I feel like as kind of a button on what is a very long, illustrious, and winding career, I think it's a really good note to go out on, for lack of a better word.
Absolutely. So, no, rest in peace, and you will be missed, Robert Forster. And then the last thing I will mention at the top before we get into the episode proper, as usual with these films, we do a non-spoiler and then a spoiler section for the movie. We will likely do the same with El Camino. However, it is inevitable. We will be spoiling the entirety of the Breaking Bad series leading up to this discussion. So if you haven't seen Breaking Bad, if you're in the midst of binge watching it on Netflix in anticipation for this movie, we're going to be spoiling it. So maybe just best to skip this episode until you've caught up.
Also, if you haven't watched all of Breaking Bad, don't watch El Camino. I promise you, it is not for you.
No, it's not. It's not a quote-unquote standalone movie. It is very much a continuation of the series. You will be lost and confused if you have not watched the series.
Yeah,
it is like a God, I hate the term, but like, would like a for fans only be the
it's a
the
love
phrase?
Letter to the fans.
Yeah. But it certainly fits because there's all the context is in the series there, so it will not play well if you have not watched the series. But yeah, let's go ahead and dive into it. So I imagine that because of that, the piece you did about all the cold opens, you rewatched the entire series recently. Is that correct?
Actually, pushes up glasses. Fun fact, I decided because, you know, A, to save time, and B, because I thought it would be an interesting experiment, and I sort of mentioned it in the intro to the piece, I just watched the cold opens. I watched the cold opens from beginning to end, and I had seen the entire series before, so I could pick up on context clues, because a lot of the cold opens are, they're sort of divided into two camps. There's the ones that are, like, you know, filling in gaps in the plot and all that stuff, and then there's the ones that are, like, explicitly thematic and kind of operate on their own, which is what the inspiration for the piece anyway. It was mostly just, like, remembering that Narco Corrido, like, mariachi Ballad of Heisenberg song in season two and be like, man, like, Breaking Bad did all of these. Like, they revolutionized the way you used cold opens. And so I wanted to, like, see what it was like to just view the Breaking Bad universe through these standalone, almost like experimental short films that happen at the beginning of each episode, and see what snapshot of the story you get there. And it's surprisingly complete for what it's worth.
Absolutely. That's incredible. And so even with that and those fresh in your mind, I mean, that's still a more refresher than I did leading up to this. I haven't watched the series probably since it ended, but I guess more back to that point before we even dive into it more, in typical Breaking Bad fashion, even though I think there's a lot of differences in El Camino, the movie does start with a cold open. It would not be Breaking Bad if it didn't. Where do you find where the cold open for El Camino landed?
In the ranking,
or just like how it lives up to the cold opens in the series.
It's like, kind of interesting because El Camino does something that to my recollection, Breaking Bad as a series didn't do, which was like having conversations with dead people. You know, that sort of, you know, standard device. You know, and you know, it begins with Jesse sort of talking to Mike about what he's gonna do, and it's very clearly him sort of like wrestling with his own thoughts about all this other stuff, because, you know, it's not like, it doesn't take place in the past. You know, Mike is clearly dead, and I guess I don't remember if Jesse ever found out that Mike died, but I know he was lied to about him dying. But it's a really interesting note to start the film on, and I think it's a really important one because it is slower, and I think it's a good signpost that this isn't going to be like an action spectacular. This is a more meditative kind of thing. It has its sort of survival Western moments, but like it's much more of a downbeat character exploration of Jesse and revisiting him and what happens to him afterwards.
And I think that was one of the most surprising things for me going like upon finishing it, is how meditative and how much more introspective it is, and how it, you know, it's not very fan servicey, for lack of a better term. Like, I feel like there's a lot of familiar characters, like you just mentioned Mike, that do pop up through the movie, whether it is in various flashbacks or in the present day, but they all feel very pertinent to Jesse's journey. Like, it doesn't cut to anybody who had nothing to do with his arc.
Saul doesn't show up in that kind
right
of stuff.
or Skyler White, like people right. who are not like super important to his arc. So I kind of admired the restraint. But one thing I am hearing people talk about, and it's kind of a shitty word, but it's something that you're hearing about, is the word unnecessary. And that seemed to be being tossed around both prior to the film. I'm seeing it a little bit now, even 2 days after the release, as the time of this recording. Necessary, unnecessary, whatever label you want to call it. What did you ultimately, as a fan of the series, what did you ultimately just feel as of El Camino as just a piece of work and how it fit into the series?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, I do want to point out that I agree with you. I think the word unnecessary when it comes to like whether or not a movie or a work of art exists is so arbitrary. I hate when people trot out that word, because no art is truly necessary. Like, because right. if you break down like what is necessary, what is unnecessary, the lines become so blurred that it basically doesn't matter. And The word necessary often comes in regards to, like, franchises or series. Like, I guess Breaking Bad slots into this. Like, I think one of the reasons it doesn't feel as fan servicey as it could, even though it is very sort of inclusionary and for Breaking Bad fans only, is because it feels less born of fan, you know, sort of uproar than it is Vince Gilligan and maybe Aaron Paul just really having this itch that they needed to scratch. And they're like, we need to know what happened to Jesse Pinkman. And yes, it is kind of this, I think, as an epilogue, as its own isolated thing, I think it is very necessary. I think it slots nicely into the themes of Breaking Bad. I mean, I know Breaking Bad is ostensibly, it's the Walter White story, but I think there is such a rich tapestry. Four seasons of Better Call Saul have proven that, in this world, that we can dovetail into other things. I mean, I feel like El Camino is unnecessary the same way Better Call Saul is unnecessary. We don't need to know how Jimmy McGill became Saul Goodman, but it's rewarding to watch. And I think the same thing applies to Jesse's post-escape, you know, flee to freedom.
I would agree, whether, like, you know, again, necessary, whatever you want to call it, that it plays super well. And it is interesting, like you said, I wanted to touch on what you said about the, like, lack of fan uproar, because Breaking Bad, as far as I can tell, is one of the few series to reach that level of acclaim and that level of just week to week watching, sitting on the edge of your seat wondering what's going to happen, and not have a super divisive ending.
Right.
That's the thing, is the ending is usually to the scene is pretty satisfying, which is rare for a series like that. Usually it's more polarizing. But yeah, like you said, Vince Gilligan and or Aaron Paul decided there was more to tell with Jesse, and it is definitely an epilogue. And to me, I feel like, even though, yes, it is the Walter White show, the series was, Paul is, I think, is every bit as good, or at least close to as good as Bryan Cranston is throughout that entire series. And so I think this is a really nice showcase for him. I think it's a really, you know, it fits in very well with the themes of Breaking Bad about choice and sort of making your bed and laying in it. I know they even talk about that in the cold open of this with Mike, of like, oh, that's something you could never do, is make things right. You can get out of town as far away as fast as you can, but you'll never make it right. And so I think that plays a lot with that. It delves a lot into a lot of trauma that he suffered in captivity in that final season. And I think a lot of that stuff is poignant. I will say, at first, the film, for people listening, it relies pretty heavily on a flashback structure. And a lot of it first, I'm kind of tiptoeing around things here, yeah, but I know you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
At first, it felt like merely just flashbacks to enforce plot that's happening in the present. Like, how did this thing happen for Jesse to go do this thing? And that was admittedly a little frustrating at the start, but then when it sort of reveals it to be more, the flashbacks to be more like how he is, the emotional state that he's in and the, like, heavy guilt that he's feeling for the things that he's done, it becomes very, very poignant, I think, by the end. I'll admit that structure was a little bit jarring at first.
I agree, but then it also opened up for me when I realized it gave Aaron Paul especially a chance to show us the different Jessies we've seen over the years. Like, it's remarkable to think about, you know, we just talked about how it's the Walter White show, but it is kind of, Breaking Bad is about how Walter White always kind of had Heisenberg in him all along, and these set of circumstances sort of lowered his inhibitions and, like, gave him the opportunity to let this, like, sort of true self out. Whereas Jesse's arc in Breaking Bad is he's very much actually shaped by the traumas and the experiences that happened to him throughout the course of the show and the effects that it has on him. And I think El Camino gives us a really good chance to see that, because, I mean, in the A plot of El Camino, Jesse is this resolute sort of trauma, you know, trauma ridden guy, but he is on a mission and he is ready to do literally anything it takes to survive. He is on his own. But we get flashbacks to, you know, earlier points in the show, and we get, you know, sort of fill in the cracks in the way that like the best cold opens did in the story. And it's amazing to see how Aaron Paul's able to, 6 years on, not just do like, you know, go back to Jesse Pinkman after the end of the show, but to see like mid-season 5 Jesse Pinkman or even season 2 Jesse Pinkman, right, and slot into that so organically.
Yeah, no, it can't be understated how much of an impressive performance that Paul gives here, and how it is such a nice showcase for him to you know, do it sans his co-lead. And I think that's one of the strengths of this film for sure.
Yeah. There's an interesting subtext too, considering Aaron Paul's career trajectory too, because after Breaking Bad, he did have his big shot at becoming a movie star. And unfortunately, it was another movie that was centered around a car, and it was Need for Speed. And I have a little bit of affection for that movie. I think people did write it off as just a Fast and Furious clone, but there is a lot of really interesting. There's some interesting stuff that happens in there. There's a really good cast. Rami Malek's in it, yeah, as one of his sidekicks. Kicks, yeah. And Imogen Poots and Kid Cudi, like. And my cat is here, and Michael Keaton is there. It's just like an outre, you know, like DJ guy. But like that flopped and he sort of languished a little bit. There was like that and some other movie that didn't really do all that well Yeah, it was like Exodus, Gods and Kings, I think he was in.
Oh,
and,
that's right.
Right. And like who would cast him in a sword and sandals thing? But I digress. But he did sort of languish a little bit. And yeah, he had a bit of a bump up with like BoJack, but that is kind of a voice role. He's not really the face of it as much. And so it's nice to see him doing this. And then of course, he's going to be in the new season of Westworld. So it's really cool to see him kind of bounce back. And I feel like I can't help but feel as though it's so nice to see Aaron Paul back as it is to see Jesse Pinkman back. And it feels oddly like they're on similar journeys in El Camino.
That's a good point, because I haven't really thought about his, like, I remember Need for Speed and I remember seeing that movie, and I think
forget Need for Speed? I know, it was a masterpiece.
It was such a great movie. No, but it did have like you said, it does have an interesting cast. And I remember having to do a Blu-ray review for that movie, and they did a lot of practical stunt work with the cars, and I think that was something that really impressed me. I don't remember Exodus as much, even though I know I saw it. He was also in, it wasn't advertised, he was in Central Intelligence too, I believe.
Oh really?
And that was a big hit, but I don't even think he was, it was sort of like a character reveal later on, so he wasn't even really marketed. And then didn't he have that show on Hulu? It was called The Path, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so he kind of just like went back to TV, which was kind of his true home, you know.
Right. So no, it's nice to have him back, and that's kind of a lot of how I feel after this, where I kind of didn't know how I felt about, you know, I don't think it was unnecessary, but I don't know how I felt about them doing this movie. But afterwards, I'm like, you know what, that was quite good, and I'm just happy to have Aaron Paul back.
Right. I think it's unnecessary if you're viewing it through the lens of, do I need this to understand the plot of Breaking Bad? But if that's your only barometer for what's necessary, I think that's really boring.
That is a boring argument for sure. Do you have any other thoughts that are a bit non-spoilery, or do we want to dive into some spoilers for El Camino?
We could talk about how the look is different, which interesting.
It is. Look, it's shot in scope.
Digital, as opposed to Breaking Bad, which was like one of the few big modern TV shows to still shoot on 35mm.
Absolutely, and it was, and it's a different DP. I forget who did it, but it's not Michael Slovis.
Something Adams or something like that.
Yeah, but it still looks good. Like, it still looks every bit of Breaking Bad. Oh, and that's the other, I guess, like non-spoiler thing I wanted to mention. Not only the look, but like, even though it is more introspective and it doesn't bounce around through different character arcs like the series did, even though it was primary Walter, like we would go back and forth between different characters. It doesn't do that here. It keeps the scope on Jesse, but everything that you liked about Breaking Bad, like the beautiful locales, montages, gallows humor, time lapses, like all of that is very much present in El Camino.
There is a time lapse where he is searching for a thing in an apartment and you see this top down god's eye view cross section of him going through this place. It's remarkable. It's one of the best shots in the thing. I think people underestimate how good Vince Gilligan is at visual storytelling.
He's so good. Like, he's one of the best, you know, you mentioned, like, how the cold open was such a pioneer in modern television. Like, his just storytelling overall is sort of, I feel, shaped what we view as prestige TV and sort of what other shows are trying to achieve. Like, it's his visual storytelling is incredible, and I'm surprised that he hasn't, I mean, if he doesn't want to, he doesn't have to, but I'm surprised he hasn't, like, moved his way into film.
Yeah.
It's strange.
Yeah, I know. And then even the sonic landscape of Breaking Bad. I mean, Dave Porter's back to do that wonderful sort of clicky ambient score that works so well. I was actually, when I was writing this, I was listening to the Breaking Bad, like, score, because I listened to a lot of soundtracks and stuff, and it's very minimalist. It's like, you know, it's definitely not, like, easy listening. I wouldn't listen to it on, like, a run or anything, but it works very well for its context. And then, of course, those great needle drops that are just such a wonderful signpost for Breaking Bad. Like, spending the night together is a really great example of that one
in El Camino. So good. Yeah. No, it was nice to revisit this world and to feel welcoming. It doesn't feel like oh, we're reinventing the wheel here. It's like, no, yeah. It's a Breaking Bad movie or Breaking Bad story, whatever you want to call it.
They're sure playing with a few new toys is like the digital filmmaking and the scope, which felt more like they wanted to capture more of this like Western feel that is absolutely like on the page in El Camino. Like, they want to do like the Sergio Leone kind of standoffs and like the landscapes and everything.
Absolutely. Well, there's a literal standoff in the
movie, yeah,
which maybe is a good time to pivot into spoilers. So yeah, if you haven't seen El Camino, both of us recommend it. Check it out. It is on Netflix, but for the remainder of this conversation, we're going to dive into some spoilers for it.
Spoilers, bitch.
That standoff scene towards the end is like, oh my God. I was literally gripping the edge of my couch during that scene because we had spent so much time, again, as good as it is towards Jesse's journey, we had spent so much time in flashbacks with characters who we already know what their fate is. And so as good as that stuff is, like, I was invested, but never felt that intensity until that moment. Actually, that's not true. I felt some of that at the beginning,
but not with Jesse, because Jesse there is a full-on gunslinger, and it feels like the end point to this sort of series of traumas he's been through. Because so much of Breaking Bad was about how reticent he was to commit violence, you know, like so much of that. And you actually see a little bit of that too. Like, if I hadn't done the cold open thing, I wouldn't have clocked the callback that happens outside of that building where he picks up the bug and doesn't kill it. Because that's a callback to, I think it's season 2, the episode where he goes to confront the meth heads with the ATM machine. Oh, and it opens on him seeing this bug on the street and not killing it. And it symbolizes that reticence he has to take life and to commit violence and to do these dirty deeds he has to do as part of this life now. Cut to El Camino, and it's not that he's like a gunslinging badass, but he is much more comfortable with it now, and maybe that's tragic in its own way.
Yeah, absolutely. But he's willing to do whatever he needs to do to be able to start over, to finally take up the offer that he was given in, was it season 5, the chance to start over?
Yeah, because we didn't see Robert Forster until season 5 of that show, I think.
Right, because it's the, is it the beginning of season 5, part 2?
I think so.
Where Walt is, because at the end of this movie, not to jump around too much, but
right,
the end of this movie takes place at that same Canadian border that Walter White went to start his new life, where Jesse ultimately ends up. So I think that's where we first are introduced to Robert Forster's character. I could be wrong, but that feels right. And then Jesse was offered the same chance and he didn't take it, which leads to an amazingly tense, humorous like scene where Jesse confronts Robert Forster's character and he gives him enough money to his fee essentially to go start a new life, and he said, no, this is what you owe me from previously, from when you didn't take it.
And he is cool as a cucumber during that entire scene. Oh my god. It's so great.
It's so both just a testament to how amazing Forster is and to how amazing
it's not Jesse's movie anymore for those 10 minutes.
No, and that's the thing, is like watching Jesse, somebody who has been so determined and so just needing to do what he needs to do throughout the movie, and he's been fairly commanding with the exception of a few things until that scene where it's like, you do not have the upper hand here. Like, you watch him try to have the upper hand for 10 minutes and it's just like, oh man, quit while you're behind. It's just like uncomfortable to watch, but it's also very humorous and just ends with an amazing, like, calling the cops, and Jesse's like, I'm calling your bluff. Okay, well.
Yeah, I don't think there's a bigger laugh line in the movie than gotta love that response time. it's so good.
It's so damn good. I did want to go back to what one of the things I found fascinating after that flashback structure. I know I mentioned it was a little frustrating at the start, mainly because it was so focused on Todd. It was so focused on that, you already mentioned, like the back half of season 5 filling in those gaps. And at first, when they were going through it, Todd takes Jesse out for a day to help him run some errands, including a cleaning lady that he had killed in Todd's psychopathic, sociopathic ways of like, I don't really want to talk about, just downplaying the fact that there's a dead body in his apartment.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where I'm like, okay, like, I know the fate of this character. This is amusing. This is entertaining. Why are we still like, why are we backtracking this other than to find that there's this money in Todd's apartment that Jesse's trying to get? But then it really comes together for me when they go bury the landlady and Jesse pulls the gun out of his glove compartment and has the opportunity to shoot Todd and flee. And that same beaten down trauma coupled with that resistance to commit violence, and the fact that Todd could take the gun, shoot Jesse, and dump him in the same grave that they just put this cleaning lady. And the fact that Todd doesn't do that, whether that's the fact that Uncle Jack would be mad about that, or whether or not he actually had in that moment a brief flash of empathy. But I feel like that's such a strength that adds to Jesse's trauma, because we know he choked Todd to death at the series finale. And so even though that character certainly deserved it, I feel like that adds a layer of like, oh, this person was nice to me for at least a second, and he could have killed me when he had the chance, and he didn't. And so I feel like that was a layer that I did not expect.
Right. It was a nice way to circle back around to what Jesse's trauma did to him, because we also see the extent to which we didn't see it all that much during his captivity, like, because we didn't get that much of it, but just seeing the ways in which he psychologically and as a person was broken down, like, he's effectively Todd's pet, and I feel like Todd treats him as such. Like, I think Todd does think that he likes Jesse. I think that he thinks that they're friends. It's just that his mind is so messed up that, like, that's what a friend looks like to him.
That's a good point.
The offer of pizza and beer, I think, is genuine in Todd's screwed up mind. So seeing the extent to which he has been broken down, Jesse has, and then seeing the ways in which he's able to overcome it by achieving these goals in the present. Like, it feels like those flashbacks are necessary because those are the things he's really fighting to escape, and we need to be reminded of that.
That's a good point. And that became clearer as they progressed. And then that sort of, any sort of hesitation or trepidation I had with it sort of disappeared as it became as we went.
And also
further.
Without them, the movie would have been 45 minutes long.
That is true. That is a good point. Like, you can't, the story that they wrote, you can't do without the flashbacks. And
a whole new set of villains too that they have to defeat for this one movie, because I don't think we heard about Candy Welding before, did we?
No, it was driving me nuts, and I wanted to, that was the next thing I was gonna bring up, because when he sees him outside after they split the money in Todd's apartment, and he's like, I was wondering when you were gonna recognize me, and I'm like,
yeah,
I don't recognize you.
Frantically searching Wikipedia, like, I think I googled Candy Welding Breaking Bad, and then I saw a bunch of other people being like, I had to Google it too. And I'm like, oh, this is just for this movie. Like, because, and maybe that's one of the reasons why people think it feels unnecessary or whatever. It's like, oh, because we had to invent a whole new set of baddies for him to defeat because all the other loose ends are tied up. It's literally just what happens to Jesse afterwards that they wanted to answer.
True, but but even then I don't think it's like unnecessary because that's the plot but not the story. So I didn't mind yeah. that. I was like, oh, I don't recognize you, but okay, whatever. That's fine. Let's just roll with this.
Right. That they're able to infuse even those characters with so much character in such short amount of time. I think it's a real testament to like Breaking Bad is so good at economical storytelling.
Right.
That we feel like we've seen those two characters who Jesse confronts in the apartment, we feel like we've seen them for at least a season, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's necessary to add to the tension-filled scene in the apartment, too, because they come in dressed as cops.
Yeah.
And
oh,
so,
God, that's like, such a great reveal, too.
It's incredible. And it helps because we don't recognize them, and so we come in and we're like, wait, are they cops or aren't they? Like, there's an actual...
There's so many little hints, because I watched it twice. And yeah, there's so many little hints, like the fact that calling the other guy lieutenant is the thing that tips him off.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Or the, are you kidding me? After they pin down Jesse, those kinds of things. Like, all these little hints. And it's great to see that Jesse, the little amateur detective that he is, like, finally picks up on that.
He picks up on it and is able to like smartly convince them of like, hey, if you shoot me here, this is a really, really bad idea. Like, there's no way out of this. And so, that's a terrific scene for sure.
I love Jesse's ability to kind of TV tropes his way out of situations. Just being like, just talking his way out of impossible situations by being like, no, wait, that's not how that works. And sort of playing armchair internet detective. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, no. Like, even though it backfires with Robert Forster, like, the points he makes, like, make sense in the abstract. He's like, no, dude, like, they, you know, you don't hang up on a 911 call. You didn't actually make that call. Like,
yeah,
I
no,
love
it's,
that thought process.
It's a valid point, like, if that was the case, but he clearly must not, you know, called whatever the local landline is, and that was that was incredible. Should we talk? I mean, it's almost unavoidable. We should talk. We should at least mention that naturally, Walter White does make an appearance in this.
Yeah,
it's a season two flashback,
yeah, I believe
roughly.
It's supposed to be 4 days out, the episode where Walter sees this, and I mentioned this in the cold open piece I did, where he sees this, like, his x-ray, and he sees this big white blotch on his lungs. He's like, oh no, things are so much worse. We have to, like, go to the desert and cook $1 million worth of meth, so that way, because I need to fast track this, because I'm going to die sooner rather than later.
That's
so
right.
This is what, I think it's supposed to take place, like, the morning after they successfully do the cook.
And then, because he mentions, like, how fast can you sell it? He's like, I don't know anybody with the spare $1.3 million, you know, sitting around.
And Walt is like, you know, he's coughing up blood. He's hacking and everything. And, like, we find out in that episode that, like, because that's another reason why he thinks he's dying quickly, is because he's still, like, hacking up crazy stuff. But that's just, like, a tear in his, like, lung or whatever that's just bleeding.
That's right, because we find out soon that he was in remission.
Right.
After that, right.
It's just, like, residual things or whatever that he misinterpreted.
Yeah, for sure. I guess I wasn't surprised. It just seemed naturally that there would be a flashback with him in it. And I like that little, like, the exchange that they have, because so many of, I mean, there've been great exchanges with them throughout the season, but there's a lot of, like, verbal abuse that came down from Walt throughout the course of the series towards Jesse.
Yeah.
And it was a nice, genuine moment of, like, you know, that foreshadowing or potential foreshadowing that Vince Gilligan is so good about, because he talks about, like, hey, like, you should go back to college, you should go into business. Like, it's the similarly to that, like, internet armchair detective thing that you were referring to. It's like, hey, you have a knack for this, you're, like, street smart. And then, of course, undercut by a great joke of, like, you gotta get your GED. He's like, I graduated high school, dick.
You were there. Yeah. No, I love that. And that was the scene I was talking about too, like, Paul being able to slip so effortlessly into season two Jesse. And that's another thing I wanted to touch on too, with that and with him and Todd and all these other actors. This is 6 years after the show ended. They look very different, these actors, but I appreciated that Vince Gilligan didn't try to do any weird tricks to like make them seem like they were the same age. Like, because I think immediately after Breaking Bad, you know, Jesse Plemons gained a little weight. And so at first, like when we first see Todd, for instance, they're filming him through these bars. And I'm like, oh no.
Yeah.
Are they going to try to like obscure? Like, it's like when actresses get like pregnant and they don't want to have, they want to hide that. So they like put him behind boxes or something.
Yeah. I thought of what is it? Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp.
Yeah. Like Michael Showalter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Where they like, but like they did
but
that
they just
as a joke.
It.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Where, but they do embrace it, and honestly, it's less distracting that they do embrace it because
right,
both because he's even though yeah, Plemons does look a little bit different, he slips so easily back into that character. And I never feel for a second that I'm like, oh, I'm not watching Todd. Like I'm watching him play this character.
Right, and if you're focusing on that, and if that takes you out of it, you're focusing on the wrong things.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
That is true.
But going back to the scene in the diner with Walt, I do think it's this wonderful moment of warmth, and I think it really ties in nicely with, again, the themes of the movie. I love Walt's sentiment that that he's really lucky that he gets to do something special so early in his life. Or right. Something like that. I'm paraphrasing. But he didn't have to wait your whole life to do something special. And there is such a bittersweet quality to it because look at what happened to Jesse because of it. But also there is this sense that like he is stronger on the other side of these experiences at the very least.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, for sure. Sorry. I'm the coffee's still kicking in for this episode. For
this
sure.
But no, Sunday morning talking
Sunday
about
morning,
Breaking Bad.
But it's incredibly rich. I'm trying to think of there was another cameo I wanted to bring up. Oh, Jane appears towards the end. Which I didn't expect. It's very brief. But I feel like that was another one that I'm like, oh, I forgot about this character and here's another one to add to that. Definitely add to that guilt.
Right. And the exchange they have, cause it's pretty much the last exchange in the movie too. And I think it's sort of poignant in terms of, you know, Jane talks about fate basically and talks about how you kind of shouldn't wait for the universe to open up for you. You do have to sort of forge your own path. And I think a little bit of that is what El Camino is about, whereas, you know, Jesse in the show, he makes his decisions absolutely, but he is sort of beholden to the whims of Walter White. Like, you know, even the fate of his and Jane's relationship is because of Walt. And so, so many of the bad things that have happened to him are not due to his choice. And so he's been, you know, whipped to and fro by the winds of fate or what have you. And it feels like El Camino, he is there at his most self-reliant and self-assured, albeit with the help of Badger and Skinny Pete, who I was delighted to see.
Oh,
and
they're so good.
They're so sweet. Like, one of my thoughts was like, you know, I know they deal meth and I know they do drugs, but I want friends as loyal and resolute as Badger and Skinny Pete in my life.
The second they show up,
so sweet.
It was like a warm blanket. Like the first scene that they're in and they're like playing Xbox and shit talking each other. I'm like, this feels right. This feels right back at it. And
Churchill.
They're wonderful. They're wonderful. They give Jesse that little boost to be able to get on. And that's another thing I really liked about this movie as well. In like this, the scene where they give him a different car, they leave the El Camino over there because it has the tracking device. I love that we never revisit that because the movie's so focused on Jesse's
Well,
because
you know what
journey.
Happened? It's genius. Like the first trailer we saw for that is Skinny Pete in the interrogation room talking about Jesse and the El Camino.
Right, right. And so they're like, we don't need to see that because that's not important.
Like, imagine using supplementary promotional material to flesh out the story so you don't need to tell it in the movie.
It's impressive for sure.
It's
and
wild.
I feel like that's something you could only do in this streaming era. Like something that you could like take a chance on like that. If it was on a network or if it was a movie that was playing in theaters, it's like you'd have to pretty much advertise it exactly as is, but I feel like that was a chance that they were able to take with this being on Netflix, and so that was really cool that didn't end up in the movie, that it was just the promotional material. Overall it impressed me, and also the other thing, in reference to Badger and Skinny Pete, I might have mentioned this on the top And maybe I didn't, but and forgive me, listeners, if I'm repeating myself, but it never felt like a checklist, which was right. really, really nice. It's like, yes, we see familiar faces, living or dead, but it never felt like, and we have to have this character, and we have to have this character, and we have to have this character. It felt very much like Vince Gilligan and Aaron Paul knew exactly what story they wanted to tell. They mapped it up smartly, and they did, they introduced whoever they needed to reintroduce, but they didn't spend a lot of time on it. And it isn't like any like aha moments. Like there's no Bohemian Rhapsody coming up with the bass line for Another One Bites Dust moments in this
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, it's not like Rogue One where like Dr. Evazan shows up on some other planet that's right. like a week before he's supposed to be on Tatooine just because like the fans wanted it.
Exactly, or Blue Milk or the You'll Be right. Dead guy. Like none of that stuff.
There is
like,
a Magnets reference.
That was...
Yeah, that was cute.
That was cute, and it was about the only thing that felt shoehorned. Like everything else felt very... important, like I don't know if important's the right word, but it felt necessary to the story that they were telling.
And yeah, when you revisited a character or a scenario, it's because the characters in the story went there. It didn't like come across it, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, and that was refreshing because that might have been my biggest worry when this project was announced. I'm like, oh no, that's not gonna like you said, not gonna Rogue One it right. or anything like that, and it doesn't. And you know, I think that shows a lot of restraint, and that shows where Vince Gilligan's head is at, as opposed to like coming up with some sort of fan servicey thing. He's like, no, this is a good story we want to tell. And they right. told it.
Yeah. Remind me, did we see Jesse's parents in the show proper? I can't remember.
Yes, we did. Yeah. And it was early on because he does go to see them. And I'm trying to remember the exact context of which it was, but it's early on. It's I want to say season two. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. And I'm glad you brought that up because that's another thing I like that I think is a strength to this movie, and it becomes clear in the scenes with them too that it's like he is saying goodbye. He is ostensibly saying goodbye to everybody. Like this yeah. isn't just a journey, like his journey to get the money that he needs and start a new life, but he's going back and saying goodbye to the people who are important to him. And even though you know, the relationship with his parents is a bit tumultuous, he still is like, you know, you're my parents.
You did your best, yeah. You have to let the past die, Ryan. Yeah. Kill it if you have to.
Kill it if you have to. Man, there's so many Star Wars references in Breaking right. Bad. I had no idea.
Right? And which is funny because on my second time through, because I'm also a huge Star Trek nerd, I saw that Skinny Pete and Badger have like a model of the Excelsior behind them when they're playing video games.
I didn't even notice. Yeah. I'd have to go back and watch that. That's like, awesome.
Such a specific little Easter egg, yeah.
That's so cool. Do you have any other thoughts on El Camino before we start to wrap this episode up?
Oh, that's a good question. I thought that I did, but then I think maybe I just said it.
Oh, fair enough.
Just the Excelsior thing. I don't know. Yeah, no, other than that, like, it's just, again, like, it feels, it's so interesting to see a movie that is so unconcerned with people who aren't already on Breaking Bad's wavelength, and I think it works to the film's credit. Like, it knows its audience, it knows what it needs, it knows what story it needs to tell. It's not like Downton Abbey, where, like, you have to have a recap of the show before you jump into the movie. And I think this is the right way to do kind of a movie continuation of a TV show.
For sure. And I'm curious too, I guess one thing maybe in the grand scheme of things, is like, would, if we weren't in the, you know, this era of streaming where sort of anything is possible, if this would have ever made it theatrically, if somebody would have made this and actually released it theatrically.
Yeah. I will say in Chicago, they're screening it at the Music Box Theater, but I think all the screenings are sold out.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me. In, right. in Seattle, they are playing it at, I don't remember the theater off the top of my head, but they were only doing it for the weekend. So doesn't matter by the time you listen to this, if you're in Seattle, it's not there anymore.
Right, right. Did have one last thought. Yeah. That landlord. Can we watch an entire TV show about that landlord guy?
Oh my God. That is, I feel like that whole, like the apartment scene, which I know we talked about at length, uh-huh. Which I don't think we connected the dots from the non-spoiler to spoiler section.
Oh,
that
yeah, yeah.
is where that overhead montage that you were talking about takes place.
Because he's looking for the money he saw that Todd showed him before. And that's mm-hmm. why we get the flashback, because he knows to go to the money because he needs the money to get the new life. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I feel like that scene, it, you know, middle of the movie, best culmination of what Breaking Bad can offer. You have your montage, you have your moments of tension, also tension undercut by Gallo's humor, thankfully, by that landlord. It's so good.
I love it so much. It's a killer set piece.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's one of the best of the film, other than maybe the climactic one in the junkyard, for sure.
Right, right. Also, what kind of asshole doesn't like pineapple?
Oh my, I was like, no, don't stoke the fires of the pineapple. I guess it's not a pizza, but the pineapple on pizza debate.
Yeah.
The great pineapple on pizza debate. We don't need any more discourse surrounding what should and shouldn't be on a pizza.
How
dare
you,
El Camino.
Pizza gatekeepers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, cool. I think we could probably put this film to bed. We both recommend it. It's streaming on Netflix, but like we said on top, this is for Breaking Bad fans only. It will not play well if you haven't seen the series. So.
Luckily, Breaking Bad is also on Netflix, so you can just binge that.
Exactly, and it's worth it. It's one of the greatest television dramas ever made. There's nothing I can add more to what people haven't already said about the series. If you haven't seen it, watch it. It has the acclaim for a reason.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, since we ran a little short before we wrap up, I figured I'd ask if there's anything you've seen this week that you want to recommend, anything you've been watching that you think people should check out.
This is a good question. I've been trying to jump in around because I'm also a film critic in addition to being a TV critic. So I have to jump around and do a bunch of I have to pull double duty, which is especially exhausting. I did just file a review for the new Netflix series Living With Yourself, the one that has Paul Rudd in a dual role. It's okay. I guess that's kind of an anti-recommendation. But I have been revisiting Star Trek Deep Space Nine just because I on the heels of Aaron Eisenberg's passing, he played one of the more supporting characters on that show, and it's amazing how great that slots into a post-peak TV era of serialization and focusing on characters. It's a really great kind of space opera. In terms of new stuff, I've mostly just been keeping up week to week with Great British Baking Show. sorry, Bake Off. Except I don't know. They call it Baking Show now, and that makes me sad. Even in the intros. But it's always fun to watch people, sort of bake things and in fancy clothes and be really nice to each other.
Absolutely. That's just one of the most pleasant shows on television. It's nice to just put it on and be like, that's the one thing that struck me when that first show first aired, first came to the U.S., where it's like, if this was a American reality challenge show, you'd have so much shit talking and
and they tried the Great American Baking Show. And it turns out that realm of pleasantness in an American context just rings as false.
Yeah, and that is very, very true. I never watched that version, but
it only lasted a couple seasons, I think. It was Nia Vardalos and her husband hosting it.
Oh, got it. Well, I'm glad this one's still
going. And now they're
going.
Split up, so love is dead.
Harsh, but fair.
Yeah. Oh, also, I'm excited for the Succession finale tonight.
Oh, yes, I wanted to bring that up. I feel we might even, I don't want to overpromise anything to listeners, but we might even do a bonus episode about the season 2 of Succession.
Cause, all right.
Because it's been quite a ride, and I'm very, really very excited for that finale. My wife and I have just, we binge watched entire season 1 and got caught up on 2, probably midway through it, and we've been kind of on pins and needles week to week.
Yeah, it's one of the great shows that's running right now.
Absolutely, could not recommend it more. That was one of the things I was gonna recommend, and I guess for me, similarly to anti-recommendation, I did see Gemini Man, which which I'm sure by your laughter you also have.
No, I've just heard the tales. Fun fact, in Chicago they did not actually invite people. They only invited certain critics to that screening.
Really?
Yeah. If you heard about the screening and you asked, you could get the invite, but I just had someone else write it for my site.
God, I hate when stuff like that happens.
It's real weird and gatekeepy.
Yeah, for sure. I did go to the one here in Seattle, although not to slander anybody, but I guess one of our fellow critics asked how it was being projected, and they said it was in high frame rate. It was not. It was it was very much in 24 and in 2D. But honestly, I didn't like. I don't know if I'd.
Did it feel like you were in a Circuit City?
No, it didn't feel like I was in a Circuit City. It didn't at all, actually. And maybe that was the 120 frames being projected at 24. Maybe made it feel more filmic. I don't know. But I don't know. I don't know if I'd recommend it, but I certainly don't have this like animosity towards it. I thought it was an interesting experiment, you know, with this just new tech that's, it's still very new in its infancy and like, could it be something someday? Absolutely. It's not quite there, but as an experiment, I found it fascinating, and Ang Lee and, Will Smith are certainly giving it their all, with just a really rough script. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. The script is, I don't think I've seen the Jerry Bruckheimer logo not in a Pirates of the Caribbean movie in forever. And so that was strange seeing it. And then it's like, oh, this was in a drawer in his office for like 20 plus years. And and it kind of plays like that.
That was the impression I got. It felt like it was probably like a mid to late 90s kind of high concept clone thriller, like The Sixth Day. That kind of thing.
That's a good comparison. And I thought it would be more, I'm trying to think. I thought it'd be more like Terminator, the way that it was sort of advertised, but, and I don't even want to bring this movie up because I feel like it creates comparisons that aren't there, but it was more Face Off, I feel like. Not as good, not even remotely as good as Face Off.
Was it loopery at all? Because the premise seems very loopery.
I mean, kind of, but ultimately not really. I'm trying to, I guess it's in the plot synopsis and it wouldn't be like a spoiler people.
It's selling point, right?
Yeah, there's no time travel involved. Let me just say that. And so so that sort of a little bit negates Looper and Terminator to a degree, but the older self facing younger self thing is a little loopery, but also not as good for sure.
I guess another recommendation that just came to mind, going back to the idea of Netflix original movies, something's going to come out in a couple weeks that I'm real excited for because I've seen it and it's great. Dolomite Is My Name.
Yes.
It's so fun.
It's really fun. I'm trying not to bury my lead because we probably will do an episode on it.
Okay.
But I also have seen it and highly, highly recommend it. Yes, it's such a delight. I didn't know how bad I needed to hear Eddie Murphy say motherfucker on the big screen again, but the second he does, and it's like one of the first lines in the movie, I'm like, oh, this, I'm home. This just feels right.
Right. And to circle, come full circle, I will be doing a guide to Rudy Ray Moore films on Consequence of Sound, I believe, sometime this next week in time for Dolomite to come out. So if you want to know about the real Rudy Ray Moore and some of his film output, it's great. Disco Godfather is like a formative text for me.
Oh, I was going to ask you, number one, I'm excited for that piece, but I was going to ask you what your favorite Rudy Ray Moore movie was.
And yeah, it's that one. Like... And weirdly enough, I haven't seen the actual Dolomite movies. It's like, I've seen that and I've seen most of Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law.
I love Petey Wheatstraw.
It's so good.
That one's probably my favorite. Human Tornado is a close second, which is the second Dolomite movie.
But yeah, I plan to catch up before I do this piece, but I'm really excited.
Awesome. No, those are great ones to catch up with. Well, cool. Clint, thank you so much for coming on the show. And again, great work on the cold open piece. Like I said, we were kind of at a standstill of what to do this week on the discourse because our friends over at the Be Real podcast on the Playlist Podcast Network are going to be doing which is a genre hopping podcast where they examine usually 2 to 3 films that have similar DNA. They're doing a Fighting With Myself pairing of Gemini Man and Fight Club. So, as I kind of mentioned to you off mic, there was no need for 2 podcasts dedicated to Gemini Man on our feed.
Right.
And then the other pickings were pretty slim. Adam's Family Movie. I didn't see it, but not something really to cover. Jexy, which I still don't believe is an actual movie that exists.
Same, right?
I saw the trailer in front of Hustlers and I was like,
this is not real, this is a commercial,
right?
For
yeah, exactly. It just doesn't feel right. And as of this morning, as I'm recording, I think the box office reflects it. It tanked pretty badly.
Is it doing like Fanatic numbers where it's like $3,000?
Not that bad because of the sheer volume of screens that it's on, but it made like 2 to 3 million. Like, that's for like a 2000 screen release. That's real, real bad.
And it got buried.
It got buried pretty horribly. And then
just in time for awards season.
Yeah. I can't wait till I get that screener of Jexy.
Oh, boy.
Put it on immediately. And then I think the last thing we were mulling around covering, which we are going to cover, but if you don't live in New York and LA or attended a fall festival, Parasite is not available to you.
Yeah, I cannot wait to see that. We still don't know when it's going to screen this week for Chicago audiences, and it's going to come out this next Friday.
Oh, wow. You guys, like, damn.
Same, I know.
Same in Seattle. It does come out the 25th for us, but like there's a bunch of screenings coming up in between those 2 weeks. So the days are getting pretty full, and we still don't have a screening yet for
Parasite. Yeah, and this is the week that the Chicago International Film Fest ramps up this week. So I'm going to be – my nose is going to be down in P&I screenings all day, all week. And so I'm going to have to slot Parasite in alongside that and Zombieland Double Tap.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It might be fine.
Totally. This may sound corny, and we may review it on the show. I'm not sure. I feel like I'm like the only person in our circles actually excited for that movie, though the first Zombieland was my wife and I's first date.
Oh,
10
wow.
years ago. So we're excited to go see it because it's like, oh, it's been 10 years. We've been together 10 years. So like that has a little bit of like a sentimental pull. But
yeah,
you know, I don't know how hopeful I am for the movie itself, but I am still excited to see it.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, awesome. Thank you again. I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. Clint, where can people find more of your work in the meantime?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Clint Worthing, where I will incessantly post about all the stuff I'm doing. You can find some of my writing at thespool.net, the site I run, but I honestly spend more time editing other people's stuff there than I do writing stuff on my own. But you can also find my written work at Consequence of Sound, where I'm a senior writer for film and TV. You can also find my dulcet tones, my dulcet stammer, tones on various and sundry podcasts, including Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast, which you can find at nathanrabin.com. Fun fact, a bit of an exclusive, we may be rebranding, or we will be rebranding in November to a John Travolta, Nicolas Cage focused podcast called Travolta/Cage, in which we posit that Face Off is the greatest motion picture of all time and sort of work our way backwards to chronologically through John Travolta and Nicolas Cage's filmographies to sort of see how these two very unique movie stars got their start and, like, you know, worked through the trajectory of their career, which I'm very interested in. And then for The Spool, I have two other podcasts, a weekly interview podcast called More of a Comment, Really, and a monthly TV podcast called Hall of Faces, where myself, Allison Shoemaker, and a panel of other TV critics, we talk about a different show each month, and we pick a character from that show to be elected to our vaunted pantheon of great TV characters.
Well, awesome. That is a lot of places that people could check you out.
I ran out of breath doing it all.
Well, I recommend people do it, and I cannot wait for the rebranding of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast.
And on Hall of Faces, we're going to do The West Wing. So if you want to find out who the greatest character on The West Wing is, tune in at the end of this month.
Cannot wait. That is also one of my favorite shows of all time, so I will have to check that out. And once again, before we wrap this episode up, the Discourse is a part of the Playlist Podcast Network, so if you enjoy the show, be sure to subscribe to our feed via your podcatcher of choice, be it Stitcher, be it SoundCloud, Anchor FM, Spotify, iTunes, or iHeartRadio, and you'll get this show as well as our other programs, including Be Real, Indie Beat, The Fourth Wall, or any of the other programs that tend to pop up on our feed from time to time. To our listeners, thank you, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
3 a.m., I'm awakened by sweet summer rain, distant howling of a passing southbound coal train. Was I dreaming, or was there someone?